and we
I'm thanking that. Anton and Hugh.
See, you guys are going to disrupt this talk, the three of you. Despite such opposition, the practice of metaphysics flourishes. There remains deep conviction that metaphysical theorizing has legitimate place in our inquiries. This dissonance has various likely sources. Disagreements about the limits of human knowledge and the nature of meaning and meaningfulness, naturalistic biases against the legitimacy of metaphysical posits, skepticism about justifying social practices by grounding them in metaphysical facts, and pessimism about transcending our theories long enough to provide non-circular accounts of their metaphysical grounds. I do not intend to adjudicate all such disputes here. My goal is to focus upon a certain understanding of metaphysics often invoked by pragmatists, highlight its inaccuracies, and suggest an alternative picture. The result is, I think, a vindication of metaphysics against some of its more interesting assailants. So, part one. Oscillations between fact and value, or description and evaluation, might contribute to ambivalence about metaphysics. Perhaps metaphysical theories are acceptable when construed as explanatory, but unacceptable when construed as justificatory. After all, explanation is not justification. Mark Johnston highlights the justificatory side of the story. This is a longish quote from his Objectivity Refigured paper, but I think we will find it helpful. Let us say that metaphysics in the pejorative sense is a confused conception of what legitimates our practices. Confused because metaphysics in this sense is a series of pictures of the world as containing various independent demands for our practices, when the only real legitimation of those practices consists in showing their worthiness to survive on the testing ground of everyday life. So defined, metaphysics is the proper object of that practical criticism which asks whether the apparently legitimating stories which help sustain our practices really do legitimate, and whether the real explanations of our practices allow us to justify them. End quote, Mark Johnston. Johnston's observation prompts an obvious concern, an immediate concern. It's not clear whether all traditional metaphysical theories qualify as metaphysics in the pejorative sense, I'll call that MP, metaphysics in the pejorative sense, or only some of them. Venerable metaphysical theories postulate or repudiate abstract entities, freedom of the will, determinate semantic content, ontological grounds of persistence, essences, naturalistic foundations of normativity, irreducibly non-physical consciousness, and so forth. Do all such theories embody equally confused conceptions of what legitimates our practices? That's Johnston's phrase. Perhaps not, in which case not all purveyors of metaphysical theories deserve to be run out of town. To legitimate a practice is to show that the practice is justified, good, or valuable in light of some standard. There are many sorts of legitimacy: moral, rational, aesthetic, legal, religious, etc. It's not clear what kind of legitimacy a metaphysical theory must purport to provide if it's to qualify as MP, that is, metaphysics in the pejorative sense, the bad kind of metaphysics, according to Johnston. Perhaps not all metaphysical theories aim to legitimate. Some might seek to explain, to show how a practice is possible, or what keeps it going, or what caused it to exist. If so, not all metaphysical theories are equally deserving of condemnation. So we've got to identify those metaphysical theories that seek to legitimate, for those other theories under attack. The claim is that no such theory can succeed because legitimization cannot be provided by a metaphysical theory. This is a bold claim indeed. What is there about metaphysical theories, and what is there about legitimization, that renders the former incapable of the latter? What is there about metaphysics that makes it unsuitable to shoulder this justificatory task? The confused kind of metaphysics, what Johnston calls metaphysics in the pejorative sense, pictures the world as, quote, containing various independent demands for our practices. To decide which theories are guilty of this infraction, we must first determine which metaphysical constructions make independent demands. This will not be easy because the relevant notions of independence and demand are notoriously subtle and elusive. But here are some examples that appear to provide reasonably clear cases in point. First example, a theory of mathematical practice might assert the existence of abstract entities and allege that correctness of mathematical claims consists in accurately reporting the features of such entities. These entities are independent of mathematical practice in the sense that they would have existed even if the science of mathematics had never evolved. Moreover, such entities make demands. The set of real numbers demands to be characterized as uncountable and renders illegitimate certain characterizations, e.g., as finite. Okay, that was the first example. Second example, a Lockean political theory might deem a social system legitimate only if it accommodates the natural rights with which people are born. The existence of such rights does not depend upon covenants, governments, or laws. Those rights are thus independent of institutional practice, but they make demands, e.g., that governments protect individual life, liberty, and property. Such a theory presumably qualifies as MP, metaphysics in the pejorative sense. Why? Because it pictures the world as containing entities, in this case, natural rights, that ground the legitimacy of treating people in certain ways. All right, I have lots of other examples of what I take to be metaphysics in the pejorative sense. Now, these examples are oversimplified caricatures. I'm simply trying to illuminate Mark Johnston's talk about pictures of the world as containing various independent demands for our practices. But what is wrong with these pictures? Why the word pejorative in his phrase, metaphysics in the pejorative sense? Apparently, such theories seek to do what cannot be done. The legitimization they purport to provide is illusory. MP theories purport to legitimate, but really are powerless to do so, because the only path to real legitimization involves demonstration that a practice is worthy, and here's the neo-pragmatist phrase, to survive on the testing ground of everyday life. That's a phrase Johnston uses. Note the pragmatist's working assumption that everyday life is free from such things as abstract entities, persistent selves, divine beings, Phrygian senses, Cartesian egos, and Lockean natural rights. Such entities are alleged to be theoretical phantasms with no respectable role in the order of legitimate legitimization. But this assumption is questionable. When suitably described, such entities do not appear to be mere philosophers' constructions removed from ordinary practice. Indeed, after we expunge our allegedly lamentable metaphysical inclinations and confine attention to the testing ground of everyday life, perhaps a god, or natural rights, or a persistent self, or determinate linguistic senses, or universals will remain on the scene. Such items might be part of our customary picture of the world and our place in it. This cannot be judged with a priori arrogance. Perhaps talk of such items plays a critical role in sustaining the practices. If so, the alleged line between metaphysics in the pejorative sense and the very data the pragmatist seeks to accommodate, right, the realities of the social practice, is difficult to draw. Example, the pragmatist might insist that only those mired in metaphysical confusion speak of meanings. But this would be wrong. I learned that mother's knee, the correct use of language, requires familiarity with word meanings and conformity to those demands. My mother, no metaphysician, merely wished to equip her children with linguistic competence. Her talk of meanings facilitated the project. Even a staunch Quinean behaviorist can accommodate such wisdom as part of the customary process of, as he puts it, beating a person into outward conformity with an outward linguistic standard. Any pragmatism that rides roughshod over ordinary linguistic practice, even one packing an ostensibly metaphysical punch, should not be taken seriously. More generally, the pragmatist's portrayal of the relation between metaphysics and practice is very suspicious. The practice is typically represented as somehow separable from the allegedly misguided metaphysical stories that purport to legitimize it. But if the metaphysical stories help sustain the practice among participants, then such stories are part of the practice and not artifacts of confused philosophical efforts visited upon the practice from an outside or sideways on vantage point. Put another way, if the practice contains a metaphysical story about itself, then legitimization of the practice demands, inter alia, legitimization of the apparently legitimizing stories embedded within it and used to sustain it. Simple example. Folk morality within a social group might be sustained by narratives about God's will and his vengeance. In that case, the theistic narratives are part of the practice, not artifacts of external theorizing. The pragmatist, given his or her avowed goals, should seek to show the worthiness of that practice, right, theism included, to survive on the testing ground of everyday life, or not. Whether that testing ground does or does not contain God's will and his vengeance cannot be prejudged. But there's an additional question of whether the apparently legitimating story that participants share about why they should proceed one way or another really does legitimate. We have no clear sense of what it would be to do that, except that it would be to show the worthiness of the practice to survive on the testing ground of everyday life. Well, Mark Johnston helps us out a little bit here. Here's something else he says. There ought to be a critical philosophy which not only corrals the developed manifestations of metaphysics within philosophy, but also serves the ends of practical criticism. Such a critical philosophy would be the content of anything that deserved the name of a progressive pragmatism, unquote Johnston. So, from what I can gather, the clear-thinking pragmatist proceeds in the following way. First, determine which of our thinkings and doings are developed manifestations of metaphysics within philosophy. B, construct a corral around them, thereby preventing their seepage into the surroundings because they are bad. C, construct the corral carefully so as not to interrupt continued participation in aspects of the practice that are uncontaminated by metaphysical artifacts. You want to precipitate this stuff out. Once the metaphysical sludge has been precipitated out of the respectable everyday stuff, it should still be possible to engage in assessment, censure, commendation, and all the other trappings of practical criticism. To be a respectable pragmatist is to do the things I've just cited. All right. The general issue so far is the relationship between metaphysics and ordinary practical concerns, between what we might call philosophical theory and the everyday. But the everyday has a certain amount of metaphysics woven into it. It isn't clear how to distill out the undesirable elements, or indeed whether they're even undesirable, and if so, why. It's hard to achieve a cut between the practice and the possibly flawed metaphysical reflections upon the practice offered from some outside vantage point. In many cases, metaphysical views are so intertwined with practical deliberations that the touted distinction between practice versus pejorative metaphysical reflection upon the practice is a difficult distinction to sustain. Nevertheless, there is a picture that the minimalist, this is what Johnston sometimes calls this kind of pragmatist, the minimalist is saying that the metaphysical posits, e.g. the kind of self that Parfit thinks he's eliminated when he thinks about ontology of persons, play a minimal, indeed a negligible role in providing justificatory foundations for our practices. There's a picture that a minimalist finds objectionable, a picture of rational agents, like us, moving about in the space of reasons, groveling in the trenches of workaday, normatively constrained life, while authoritative transcendent objects loom over us, making demands about how to act, and threatening us with delegitimization if we go on in one way rather than another. These are the superlative entities of the familiar metaphysical pictures, and the minimalist pragmatist claims that such entities, if they exist at all, are not the crucial justifiers of our attitudes and practices. Now note that love of desert landscapes, that is, commitment to ontological parsimony, is not the driving force behind this kind of pragmatist minimalism. Metaphysical entities might have a respectable place in the order of explanation. Rather, the minimalist is driven by a view about the nature and locus of justification. He or she denies that legitimization of a practice can be provided from the outside. Unfortunately, we have yet to determine how to distinguish the inside from the outside. All right. What I'm not going to read in the interest of saving time is something that I'm sure I should be reading, but okay. So the minimalist regards ordinary practice as Johnston says, as having given no crucial hostages to metaphysical fortune. Changes in metaphysical theories mandate no changes in our practices, so he disagrees with Parfit. You recall in the early work on personal identity, Parfit says, if you change your views about the ontology of persons, then certain moral principles that constrain us will lose their hold upon us, and Johnston began this project by saying, that's just not right, I don't care what notion of a human or non-human self you've got floating around, these moral principles, weighted self-interest and things like that, do not lose their force, even if the self is as Parfit claims it to be. So changes in metaphysical theories mandate no changes in our practices because, as Johnston describes it, metaphysical pictures of the justificatory undergirdings of our practices do not represent the crucial conditions of justification of those practices. Okay. Now I have my enemy, I hope, reasonably well characterized. I suggest that pragmatist misgivings rest upon faulty interpretations of the metaphysical enterprise. Alternative interpretations prove friendlier to pragmatist scruples. So here's what I suggest we do. Step one, let P be some institutional practice. Discursive practice, I don't care, religious practice, academic practice. Let L be a specification of the conditions that render it worthy of survival. By the pragmatist's own lights, L legitimizes P. L involves no superlative entities, no reference to independent demands upon P. Step two, the crucial step, encode the content of L in a picture. Pictures often convey the content of sets of conditions. Think of Venn diagrams, helpful mechanisms that encode information about category inclusions and relations among properties. One need only insert the interpretive caveat that categories and classes are not circular. Another example, graphs of density against distance for longitudinal waves provide a helpful picture of areas of compression and rarefaction. One need only learn how to interpret the picture. You've got to learn how to read the picture. My claim, metaphysical theories can be regarded as encodings of information about normative forces that sustain a practice. Given L, the legitimate legitimizer of practice P, the content of L is representable in a metaphysical picture S. A picture of universals, or the self, or natural rights, or meanings. When suitably interpreted, that picture portrays the very forces countenanced by the minimalist. The metaphysical theory is a mechanism by means of which a practice articulates the normative forces operative within itself. If this pragmatist-friendly construal of metaphysics is to be of metaphysical pictures is to be rejected by the minimalist pragmatist, he or she must deploy an interpretation of S, that's the metaphysical picture of universals or natural rights or what have you, according to which it plays no role in sustaining P, and can thus be eliminated without thereby jettisoning the practice. But any such interpretation requires defense. It would be fascinating if the minimalist pragmatist were fueling his or her anti-metaphysical bias, this is a sort of punchline, by applying the wrong interpretive rules to metaphysical pictures, thereby conveying a false sense of their undesirability and the need to eliminate them. The point is that any picture or diagram or map can be misread. Metaphysical pictures are no exception. If S is a mechanism that expresses a practice's sense of its own conditions of justification, then the minimalist has no business denigrating it. The metaphysical picture might be a valuable tool that enables a practice to sustain and legitimize itself. Tentative upshot. The pragmatist should spend less time dismissing traditional metaphysical pictures and more time trying to figure out what information such pictures encode and thus what role they might play in sustaining and regulating our practices. Therefore, a fundamental dispute between the minimalist pragmatist and their opponents, such as myself, concerns the proper interpretation of metaphysical pictures. Now, the need to provide such interpretation is very often overlooked. But one person who does not overlook this need and who describes it beautifully is Michael Dummett in his William James lectures. Here's another sort of lengthy quote from Dummett, Logical Basis of Metaphysics, but I think it's absolutely beautiful. Quote, "We also face another and greater difficulty to comprehend the content of the metaphysical doctrine. What does it mean to say that natural numbers are mental constructions, or that they are independently existing immutable and immaterial objects? What does it mean to ask whether or not past or future events are there? What does it mean to say or deny that material objects are logical constructions out of sense data? In each case, Dummett says, we are presented with alternative pictures. The need to choose between these pictures seems very compelling, but the non-pictorial content of the pictures is unclear." That's Dummett. Well, inspired by Dummett's sentiments, I'll here explore ways to comprehend the non-pictorial content of two metaphysical pictures, one concerning possible worlds, the other concerning properties. There were actually three, one of which involved the picture of the world as what Quine describes as a seething, shimmering mass or mess devoid of intrinsic individuation. This is the so-called blob ontology, and it's in this context that I invoke my hero Steve McQueen, who was, of course, pursued by a blob. I've had to suppress that, but I mention it because David wanted me to mention it. Okay, so first way to implement the sort of construal of metaphysics that I'm advocating. There could be a dispute about the metaphysical status of possible worlds. Let's chew on this one and see what we get. Two options are customarily available. Option one, possible worlds other than the actual world exist. They differ from the actual world in various ways, foremost among which is that we do not inhabit them. Possible worlds and their denizens enjoy mind-independent reality. The truth or falsity of ordinary modal and counterfactual claims depends upon what goes on in possible worlds other than our own. That's option one. Here's option two. The only possible world that exists is the actual world. Truth conditions for modal and counterfactual claims concern what goes on in this world, for this is the only world there is. Granted, possible world semantics is a helpful tool for exploring and modeling the structure of modal discourse, but the ontologically bizarre entities spawned by such semantic theories should be treated with instrumentalist indifference. All right, now we have to say a little bit more about how to implement this. So let's get a little bit more specific. Let PW be a standard Kripke-style semantics for a modal fragment of natural language. PW will deploy all the familiar apparatus, possible worlds, accessibility relations and similarity orderings, domains of individuals associated with each world, mappings from worlds to extensions, denotation at a world, truth at a world, you know the drill, and the like. So necessarily P is true at a world W if and only if P is true at all worlds accessible from W. If P were the case, then Q would have been the case, is true at a world W if and only if Q holds at all P worlds relevantly similar to W, and so on. This is a metaphysical picture. Never mind that you could use it to do model theory for modal fragments of discourse. There's a metaphysical picture here. Possible worlds are spread out through Kripke space like raisins in a pudding, as Larry Powers once put it. Facts about those worlds are truth makers for modal claims made in the actual world. We may argue about the correctness or coherence of this picture, insisting that the only existent entities are actual entities, or that modal claims made in this world have nothing to do with truths about other worlds, or that the very idea of a non-actual existent is unintelligible. But look at option two. It denies that the metaphysical picture embedded in PW provides a ground, either a legitimizing foundation or a causal explanation for our ordinary practices of endorsing or disputing modal claims. PW can be regarded, that's the possible world semantics, as a helpful mechanism for codifying aspects of modal discourse, clarifying modal intuitions, regimenting modal inferences, and recursively characterizing truth from modal assertions. PW is no metaphysical foundation of our modal practice, nor is it part of the best explanation of that practice. PW provides no external point and anchor for modal discourse, no justificatory undergirdings for the way we talk and think about possibility or counterfactuality. The worlds depicted in PW place no demands upon us. Rather, the worlds depict the demands we place upon ourselves. That's a punchline. The claim is that talk of possible worlds is essentially picturesque redescription, equivalent to talk of possibility and necessity. On this interpretation, PW is an algebraically tractable depiction of the descriptive and inferential norms constitutive of modal discursive practice. Such interpretation, if I'm going to get away with this, requires a demonstration that PW, now this is an overstatement, this actually is not required, but it would be nice if we had it, and I don't think we do, that PW is a conservative extension of ordinary modal discourse. No new deductive consequences, no new semantic consequences. That would be hip, because that would show that modal discourse, a possible world's discourse, is not really adding anything, right? It's not letting us prove anything new. It's not getting us new model theoretic consequences. What was already there, we're just drawing a picture of what was already there of the discursive practice. So, pending these demonstrations, the metaphysical minimalist should postpone anti-metaphysical surgery, right? Before you take these possible worlds away from me, you better ask what they are. Maybe they're pictures of some aspect of discursive practice, which a pragmatist would find perfectly congenial. If talk of possible worlds aspires not to provide an external point and anchor or legitimize everyday modal practice, but merely to provide a useful adjunct to those practices, analogous to record books wielded by public accountants, then there's little basis for pragmatist misgiving. So we don't have to throw the possible worlds theorist out. Okay? Here's effort number two to implement the kind of strategy I advocate in another portion of metaphysical discourse. There could be a dispute about the existence and nature of universals. One faction might insist that universals are abstract entities. Again, you know the drill. Eternal, immutable, non-localizable in space-time, multiply instantiable, not dependent for their existence upon mental or linguistic activity. Such entities, it is alleged, enter into explanations of resemblance, of causal power, of law-likeness, of truth. And such entities, it's alleged, also enter into justifications of classifications, of linguistic behavior, and other aspects of ordinary practice. And these explanations and justifications are often claimed to be uniquely metaphysical. But here's another way to look at this. Another faction might insist that talk of universals and other abstracta is perfectly legitimate, but best understood as not explanatory and not justificatory. The function of such talk, rather, is to make explicit the norms operative in our ordinary linguistic practices. Such a view, best dubbed social conceptualism, was in fact articulated and developed by Wilfred Sellers. The key idea is that talk of the universal redness, for example, is to be analyzed as talk of the role played by the linguistic item red, or the dot red, as Lionel said earlier. That role is a complex phenomenon, involving inferential connections, norms of correctness governing reactions to sensory input, norms of correctness governing non-linguistic behavior, and all the other normative trappings. Although linguistic roles are themselves abstract entities, notice they are constituted by, rather than determinants of, institutional practice. So universals, on this view, are neither explainers nor justifiers. They are reifications, they are pictures, right, of the norms sustained within ordinary linguistic activity. Now, this kind of interpretation, again, has to be fleshed out in considerable detail, and I've tried to do that elsewhere. Note for present purposes that it purports to be consistent, here's another punchline, with continued engagement in ordinary discourse about properties. I could argue with George Beeler about properties, relations, and propositions all I want and not feel a sense of guilt, and I don't have to feel I'm doing something that will make my pragmatist friends reprimand me. I lost my place, of course. That purports to be consistent with... It provides an interpretation of such discourse that portrays it asserting to codify rather than justify. Thus construed, even the pragmatist minimalist can acquiesce with clear conscience in a metaphysics of properties without feeling that he's made a concession to transcendent determinants of correctness on which ordinary practice depends. So I can speak about anti-rem universals with the best of them, but not feel that I'm... putting some sort of external constraint on practice that the pragmatist might complain about. All right. Here's an analogy that I find exceptionally helpful, and some of the people with whom I've talked about this tell me that this is helpful, so I'll share it with you. Consider a possible controversy about the proper role of dictionaries in regulating linguistic practice. A semantic minimalist might balk at holding speakers accountable to the demands of a dictionary, and insist that ordinary discourse has given no crucial hostages to the fortune enshrined in dictionaries. Such opposition would be unwarranted. A dictionary merely encodes information about the way things are done, the communally sustained linguistic norms and uniformities that enable speakers to engage in fluid dialogue. Thus construed, there's little basis for pragmatist misgiving. Dictionaries are empirical documents. Nevertheless, they can play a normative or regulative role, insofar as speakers strive to conform to communal uniformities. Or the pragmatist to view metaphysical theories as analogous to dictionaries, providing codifications of ordinary practice and thereby serving as tools for regulating them, the anti-metaphysical sentiment would be dispelled. No self-respecting pragmatist need advocate the elimination of dictionaries. Dictionaries are thus an important case study in the present setting. In a sense, dictionaries vindicate minimalism. The linguistic practice would go on as it does, even if there were no dictionaries. But in a sense, that's not right. Yes, there's no content to the dictionary beyond what's imminent in the practice. The dictionary doesn't undergird the practice or legitimize the practice. That's true enough. And yet, ironically, and here's where the... One aspect of the total linguistic practice is to write dictionaries and distribute them as aids to speaking and writing properly. Any effort to acknowledge the primacy of practice, you pragmatists, must accommodate dictionaries and their use. Don't throw them out. Try to make sense of what role they're playing, a regulative role, maybe slowing down linguistic change. And not ridicule them as misguided efforts to ground linguistic practice in transcendent forces. Pragmatists do not have to throw dictionaries out of the window. The dictionary analogy, if sound, points toward the acceptability of metaphysics on pragmatist grounds. Metaphysical theories codify practices, as do dictionaries, rather than provide external points and anchors for their legitimization. The objects spawned by metaphysical theorizing do not make independent demands. They are rather pictorial representations of the demands implicit in the practices themselves. Last page, and then I will thank you for your patience. Various strands of pragmatism claim to be conservative, conservative in the sense that they respect the primacy of practice, enabling folks to go on as before in their ordinary, normatively constrained activities, while freeing them from the dread pretensions of transcendent metaphysics. The claim is that we can and should see our forms of life as metaphysically ungrounded, without thereby sacrificing our commitment to those forms of life or our sense of their legitimacy and importance. These pragmatist strategies purport to be non-revisionist or non-reformist of our first-order practices. But the touted distinction between first-order practice and higher-order metaphysical reflection upon it is itself questionable. Participation in a form of life involves, among other things, a sense of what one is doing, why one ought to do it, and what sorts of conditions are acceptable or intolerable. And metaphysics is often a vital component in articulating such sentiments. Any effort to surgically remove fragments of metaphysical theorizing from everyday activity would be disruptive. Pragmatist surgery will not, after all, conserve everyday practice. And yet this is not what the pragmatist wanted. So the solution is to allow the metaphysician to go on as before, but recalibrate our sense of what he or she is up to. Closing paragraph. American industrialist Henry Ford once said that every object tells a story if you know how to read it. Ford's wisdom applies not only to familiar cultural artifacts like houses and cars, but also to the objects postulated by metaphysical theories. The moral of my discussion today is that stories told by such objects, universals, non-human self, propositions, what have you, are consistent with pragmatist agendas. A metaphysical theory can exert both descriptive and normative force within the fabric of our practices without overstepping the bounds of good sense. Whether such theories are beneficial or disruptive, however, is an additional question, and I've not tried to talk about that. That's it. Thanks.